Yeah, we've always been solid.
We have, haven't we? I think it's been a marvelous partnership. You keep your product out of Worcester, and when my business secures product from other sources that would be of interest to you, I provide it to you at a price far below market value, that you then resell at whatever price you deem fair. I keep my city clean, I make some money, you make some money, and everyone's happy. That is a wonderful working relationship, don't you think?
Of course I do.
And we've always gotten along personally, haven't we?
Sure, man. You're good people.
I think highly of you as well. That's why I'm giving you an opportunity to come clean with me. If you're behind the sudden influx of oxy, just say so. Be honest. Be a professional. Be a friend. And say so.
Erkan.
Don't say anything quite yet. Erkan walked around behind his desk and dug around in a drawer. Manish, suddenly pale, turned away. Hammond moved a step closer.
You of course know Murph the Narc and Leo Eden, Erkan said. He had a tablet in his hand.
Sort of, Park said. By reputation, mostly. I think I met Leo at a party out at...
As I said, you were among my first meetings. I met with Murph and Leo earlier today, and had similar conversations with them, Erkan said quite pleasantly. I gave them both an opportunity to be upfront with me about their activities during my convalescence. Murph was, to his credit, completely honest. He confessed he used my absence as an opportunity to bolster his heroin business. At least until I got back on my feet, he claimed. But you know how things like this can get out of hand.
Erkan turned the tablet around to present the screen. Park didn't immediately recognize the man, but his identity was beside the point. His skin had a faint blue tint to it, his eyes were open but unseeing, shot through with pink and absent of light.
Now, Leo, Erkan said, turning the tablet around and giving it a few taps. He lied to me. I knew that because Murph, in a desperate effort to buy back his own life, told all.
He flipped the tablet again. Park recoiled and jammed a fist into his mouth to keep from vomiting. He had indeed met Leo once, at a party hosted by a mutual friend. A party for which Leo had provided the entertainment in the form of 6 girls, all fresh off the proverbial boat, all of them hovering around the age of consent, all of them strung out so badly their compliance could be purchased for the low, low price of a dime bag. They spoke only briefly, Park and Leo, and said nothing of consequence. It was a forgettable encounter, but Park tended to remember faces, if not the names attached. He risked one more look. He remembered the face. What was left of it? Leo Eden's head lolled at an impossible angle, as if the vertebrae in his neck had been removed. Something had caved the cap of his skull in with such force it ejected his eyes from their sockets. The point of an iron hook jutted from his chest.
Jesus fuck, Park groaned.
Erkan, mercifully, lowered the tablet. His easy smile hadn't flickered.
Someone tried to take me off the board, Arnold, and others capitalized on that. I've worked very hard to turn this city into something good, something to be proud of, and I will be damned if I let all that hard work come undone.
Erkan hunkered down. It was the first time Park could ever remember looking Erkan in the eye without craning his head.
Out of respect for our friendship, I'll be honest with you. You are going to die here.
You can't, Park rasped. All those people out there, your workers.
Them? Yes, they are my employees. But they don't work here.
A gush of volcanic heat rose out of Park's collar, racing up to meet the sudden waterfall of sweat cascading down his face.
The regular staff has been given the week off. Paid, of course. No one down there will see or hear a thing.
So.
Erkan stood. He seemed a giant.
I was honest with you. You be honest with me.
Erkan, come on, man. Park's fingernails dug into the armrests. Why would I ruin a good thing, huh? What kind of fucking sense does that make?
Erkan sighed heavily. Oh, Arnold.
It was an old-fashioned technique, but an effective one. Hammond, unnoticed by Park, removed from his pocket a makeshift sap, one thick athletic sock inside another and filled with sand. He swung it like a medieval knight with a chain flail, bringing the weight down square onto Park's skull. The impact fell short of rendering him unconscious, but that was acceptable. Preferable, even. Park failed to come clean and thus lost his right to a clean death, like the one visited upon Murph, who suffocated inside a length of industrial shrink wrap pulled tight across his face. Hammond carried out that relatively kind execution. Erkan himself had wielded the 16-pound sledgehammer that delivered Leo Eden to the next world, but he had to let Hammond hoist him onto the meat hook mounted inside one of the box trucks parked downstairs. The truck to which Hammond carried Park, over his shoulder like a sack of potatoes. The refrigeration unit running at full blast would keep the bodies from rotting, but it did nothing to mute the sickly sweet stench of bladders and bowels that had released in death. The smell didn't bother Erkan in the least. He barely noticed it. He whistled a meandering tune as he took off his suit jacket, which he handed to Manish, then donned an apron and face shield he'd acquired from a coroner friend, and then a pair of leather gloves.
"Sir," Manish said to his shoes,
"may I?"
"Yes, Mr. Manish, if you must," Erkan said.
Manish, who must, jumped out of the trailer and pulled the roll-down door closed behind him.
"Mr. Hammond, if you would."
Hammond lowered Park to the floor, propping him up on his knees. He swayed, but stayed upright. Hammond, lacking protective gear, stepped back, out of the splatter zone. Erkan picked up the sledgehammer. Flakes of reddish grit fell from the solid steel head. Park's head lolled back, each eye pointed in a different direction.
"Erka," he gurgled.
"I really did like you, Arnold," Erkan said, as if in apology. "Couldn't stand that god-awful hat, though."
Erkan swung. The sound reminded him of the time he and his best friend in grade school, Milo, dropped a watermelon off a highway overpass, just to see what would happen. This was so much more satisfying.
"Mr. Hammond, put Park up next to Mr. Eden, would you?" Erkan said.
He thought for a moment, then gestured to the other body, sitting upright in the corner, that of Murph the Narc, his dead eyes seeing nothing.
"Him too."
Hammond did as told, then stepped out of the trailer to wash his hands. Erkan took out his phone to take a photo of his growing collection. It would grow further before the day ended.
"I really did like you, Arnold," Erkan said.
Isabel greeted Erkan at the door with a kiss and a glass of 18-year-old Oban. "How did it go today?" she asked.
"It was disappointing," Erkan said.
"Come, sit." They walked arm in arm into the living room, where a dozen rough rectangles of dark color checkerboarded a section of the western wall, which was normally a soothingly generic off-white. Eggshell or ivory, Erkan could never remember which. Isabel cleared some space on the coffee table for Erkan to set his drink, pushing aside a three-ring binder filled with fabric and leather swatches. The great redecoration project had officially begun.
"I'd like to put in a vote for leather for the couch," Erkan said as he sat on their current couch,
a perfect color match for the walls.
The notion of owning furniture he wasn't terrified of staining merely by sitting on it appealed to him.
Noted. But we can discuss interior decorating later.
Isabel curled up next to her husband.
Tell me.
I spoke with 4 people today. People I considered trusted, loyal allies.
Erkan swirled his drink and took a sip. He swished the liquor around his tongue, savoring the notes of honey and fruit. It burned pleasantly all the way down his throat.
As it turns out, they were not trustworthy. They were not loyal. And they were not allies.
They moved in as soon as you were out of the picture, didn't they?
They did.
I wish I could say I was surprised.
She leaned closer and said into his ear,
How did you handle it?
As you suggested. Authoritatively.
Isabel raised a curious eyebrow. Erkan, his manner clinical, told her how he answered their betrayals.
I took pictures.
Show me.
Erkan took out his phone from a pocket inside his suit coat. He entered the passcode and pulled up the images. Isabel took the phone from him and swiped through the photos once, then a second time, lingering on each one before moving on to the next. Her expression was one of cool, scholarly fascination.
Manish, naturally, did not care for any of it, Erkan said. He was rather appalled that I'd resort to such extreme measures.
He would be,
Isabel sniffed.
Now, be kind. I understand his apprehension. I've always handled these issues as a professional would, as a gentleman. This is a radical departure from my established modus operandi.
A necessary departure. You were not the one who abandoned civil discussion as a means of addressing a problem. You are simply responding in kind.
What you receive is what you repay.
Exactly.
Isabel swiped through the photos again.
A fine start to your collection.
I don't intend to add to it more than is strictly necessary. What's the point of sending a message when there's no one left to hear it? Besides, you know how these things work. Nature abhors a vacuum. If I clean house and get rid of everyone who betrayed me...
Which is likely everyone.
Then every aspiring big shot would move in to fill the void, and I'd be right back where I started years ago, fighting to bring the pushers and pimps to heel.
Perhaps, Isabel said. Or perhaps you could fill those vacancies personally, with people you can actually trust.
If this experience has taught me anything, it's that I can't trust anybody.
Erkan sagged under the weight of this admission.
Not so. You have Mr. Manish. You have Mr. Hammond.
Isabel kissed him.
I have you.
Always. And?
She tapped the phone.
You have this. This would make it clear to anyone you bring in. This is what awaits those who cross you.
An idea sprang into Erkan's head. It was daring. It was perverse. It would take a considerable outlay of capital to get the work done quickly, and, more importantly, quietly. He nodded to himself. It would be worth it.
There's something else, he said.
What?
I asked everyone what they'd heard about the hit, who might have been behind it. They all mentioned Octavio Ham.
Ham? He's never shown any interest in Worcester before.
That we know of. His profile's almost as low as mine. Mind you, no one offered anything solid, so this could be nothing but the word on the street.
But it's enough to warrant further investigation.
Enough for my comfort.
Isabel took the glass from Erkan's hand and took a sip.
Promise me something, she said.
Anything.
If Ham is responsible for what happened to you...
A storm raged in her eyes.
I want to be there when you kill him.
I want to watch him die.
If you want, Erkan said, I'll let you swing the hammer yourself.
Isabel smiled. 11. Mary Reed, born in Devon County, England, in 1685. Mary Reed, alias Mark Reed, that pseudonym stolen from a brother who died soon after Mary's sinful birth out of wedlock. Mary's mother forced her to live that lie into her teens. It was the only way to keep Mary's grandmother's purse open and her patronage flowing. In adulthood, Mark Reed served as a footman, merchant sailor, and soldier before shedding her identity to Mary, only to reclaim it after her husband's death. In 1720, while traveling to the West Indies in search of a fresh start, Mark's ship was captured by pirates, and she was pressed into service aboard their vessel by its captain, John Calico Jack Rackham. The rest of her days would be spent sailing under Rackham, but her life became inextricably entwined with another member of the ship's crew, Rackham's lover, Anne Bonny. Rose lingered on that passage, her fingertip hovering over the name. Anne Bonny. Anne, likewise dressed as a man, found herself attracted to Mark, and revealed her secret to him, intending to pursue an illicit affair under Jack's nose. This caused Mary to do the same in return. Historians generally agreed the women became fast friends in that instant, and forged a bond stronger than the one Anne shared with Jack. But opinions diverged as to the exact nature of the women's relationship. Some maintained it was platonic, others insisted it was romantic. Regardless, the trio raised its share of hell until November 1720, when Jack, who loved his drink more than he loved Anne, hosted a bacchanal on his ship, the Revenge. Famed pirate hunter Jonathan Barnett capitalized on this and attacked the Revenge with the intent of taking the captain and his crew alive. Jack, a coward as well as a drunkard, fled to the hold along with his guests, leaving Anne and Mary to fight the boarding party themselves. Mary, outraged at being so abandoned, fired a gun into the hold, into her shipmates, killing one man and wounding another. Rose smiled. Instead of joining the fight, Rackham surrendered the ship. He and his crew were all tried, convicted, and sentenced to hang for piracy. The last thing Rackham heard before dancing at the end of a rope was Anne Bonny raging, "Had you fought like a man, you need not have been hanged like a dog." Rose's grin widened. Anne and Mary pled their bellies to escape their own death sentences. For Anne, the ploy worked. She was released, and several accounts maintain she later gave birth to Rackham's child, her second. Her first, by a different man, was believed to have died in childbirth. Whether Mary's pregnancy was real or feigned became a moot point when, in April 1721, she died in jail of a fever. No, that's not right. Anne's ultimate fate remained to this day a point of debate among historians. The consensus was that she simply vanished from the pages of history, but a minority contended she eventually settled down with a man named Joseph Burley, to whom she gave 8 children before her death in 1782. 85 years old. More than 60 of those years without her Mary.
"You okay?" Calvin asked.
Yeah, fine, Rose said. Why?
You look sad.
He glanced at the cover of her book, wrapped in a library standard cellophane slipcover.
The Encyclopedia Piratical?
Someone left it in the break room at work, Rose lied. Calvin grunted and resumed staring at the TV, marking the end of the longest conversation they'd had since Friday. Calvin hadn't commented on Rose's night out with her unnamed friend, nor on their rough tumble on the couch. A dark stain, the evidence of their crime of passion, marred the cushion Rose sat upon. They hadn't spoken much the following day out of respect for Rose's hangover, and Rose was back on duty the day after that. Calvin spent every one of those nights on the couch.
Are you sleeping here again tonight? Rose asked. Calvin shrugged. I'd like it if you came back to bed with me. He glanced at her, gave her a small nod, then returned his attention to the television. Would you please talk to me?
What do you want me to say?
I don't know. Anything. Ask me how my day was. Ask me how my book is. Talk to me.
Calvin turned off the TV. What the hell was Friday night about?
What do you mean, what was Friday night about?
You went out without calling me. You got drunk. You came home and you... Jesus, I don't know what that even was.
I fucked you, Rose said. I've fucked you before, you know. Lots of times.
Not like that.
You didn't like it?
It was scary.
Rose started.
It was scary. It wasn't like you at all.
Calvin hesitated.
The doctor said you might... He said personality changes weren't uncommon in people who...
I don't have brain damage, Calvin. Christ!
That wasn't you, Rose. That was not you.
Rose lost the staring contest that ensued. I had too much to drink.
Also not you. I've seen you drunk maybe twice in my life, and both times were at weddings.
I got a little carried away. I met this woman through work. We hit it off. She invited me out to drinks. She's a little on the wild side, and I got carried away. That's all.
Calvin frowned.
I swear, that's all it was.
I didn't like it.
You don't like much of anything about me these days, do you? You don't like that I went back to work. You don't like that I have nightmares, as if I have any fucking control over that. I can't go out with friends. I can't even fuck you without you complaining. I'm not the person you want me to be, and you can't...
Rose bit down on all of it, chewed it up, swallowed it.
I'm sorry, she said. The words were bitter on her tongue, acidic, like bile.
Calvin nodded. There was no return apology.
Come to bed with me? Rose asked. Calvin followed her into the bedroom. They stripped down to their skin and crawled under the covers. Calvin fell asleep within minutes. Rose, eyes closed but wide awake behind her eyelids, pulled his arm around her and held it there across her chest, while she quietly cried herself to sleep. She woke up at 3 a.m, her bladder demanding attention. The bed next to her was empty.
1 decaf, Alduin said, proffering the Duncan's cup.
Decaf? Rose said. What did I ever do to you?
As a highly trained law enforcement officer, I'm trained to assess an individual's state of mind and de-escalate situations whenever possible. I assess that you're ready to lose your shit on the first person to give you a ration of grief.
And you thought decaf was the best way to de-escalate me?
I stand by my decision.
At least Alduin thought to load it up with sugar, so there was that.
How long are we going to sit here being a cliché? Rose said.
Do you see any donuts in this cruiser? I don't see any donuts in this cruiser.
Alduin took Rose's side eye with good grace.
We're going to sit here until you tell me what's bothering you.
I'm fine.
No, you're not. Something's bugging you, and I need to know what it is.
Need to?
As long as we're riding together, yes, I need to know. Because I need to know you're good to watch my back.
The fair point raised, Rose said simply, Calvin.
Again?
Still.
Gotta get over it.
Yes, he does.
I mean you.
Excuse me? What do I have to get over?
The fact Calvin's not getting over you getting shot?
You're taking his side?
I'm seeing things from his perspective.
Same difference.
No, it's not.
Look, Alduin said, twisting sideways in his seat.
The guy almost lost the woman he loves to this job. Don't you think he has a right to be upset that you came back to it?
Don't I have a right to make that decision?
Yeah, of course you do. But you don't have the right to dictate how he reacts to it. It's his process. You can't rush him or tell him he's doing it wrong. You know you'd be royally pissed if the situation were reversed.
Rose, scowling, took a sip of her decaf. Owen said pretty much the same thing.
Marie and I agree on something? Shit, the end is nigh. Can I offer some advice?
Alwyn said. Rose gestured vaguely.
Stop trying to force the issue. Just be a normal couple for a while. Do some normal couple stuff, like, I don't know, host a dinner party or go to the movies, that sort of thing.
Your solution to my problem is to ignore my problem? That's what Calvin's been doing, and maybe you missed this part. It hasn't helped.
All I'm saying is to back off a bit and stop trying to leapfrog over all your baggage.
I am not the one with baggage.
If you say so.
After a moment, Rose asked, "Would you have come back?"
"What, if I'd been shot and nearly died?"
Rose nodded without correcting him about the nearly part.
"Hell no," Alwyn said.
"Really?"
"My wife wouldn't even have to ask me. Shit, if I dodged a bullet like that, I mean, you know, symbolically, metaphorically, whatever."
"Do you think I made the wrong decision? To come back?"
"You made the decision you thought was right for you, which I respect the hell out of, FYI.
She managed a weak smile. "Yeah?"
"God, yeah. You are hands down the ballsiest person I know. Taking 3 in the gut and coming back for more? You know, symbolically."
"Metaphorically?"
"Whatever."
"I forgive you for the decaf." She jerked a thumb. "Let's get out of here." They were halfway through their mid-morning coffees when they found the car. What was left of it? Car theft was a regular problem. Some fell victim to teen joyriders, some were boosted for use in a robbery and abandoned immediately afterward. But most were taken to be stripped down for parts at one of the local chop shops. Those cars were rarely, if ever, recovered. Their dismantling was so complete. The mustard-yellow Buick they found under the Route 290 overpass was relatively intact. It had been thoroughly gutted. Everything from the engine to the seats to the spare tire had been removed, but the panels were still attached to the frame. A closer inspection revealed that the VINs had been obliterated from the dash, the frame inside the engine compartment, and the driver's side door jamb. The one inside the rear wheel well, the one amateurs often missed, was intact, but Rose and Alwyn were already certain they'd found the remains of a vehicle belonging to a Shrewsbury man reported missing 2 days earlier. His girlfriend said he left after lunch to attend a business meeting in Worcester. She didn't know where or with whom, and never returned home. "He always came home," she said. "Always." It wasn't at all like Arnold Park to not come home. 12. Moby leaned on his horn, letting it blare for a full 30 seconds. Manish appeared presently and hustled up to the security gate, a waist-high strip of chain link hinged to a steel post on one side and padlocked to an identical post on the other.
"Check this dude," T said. "Got his suit from his daddy's closet." "Wearing big boy clothes," Moby laughed.
He leaned out the driver's side window.
"Hurry up, fool! Got shit to do!"
Manish popped the padlock and opened the gate. Moby brought the electric blue Cadillac inside.
"Mr. Mantle," Manish said. He glanced at the unexpected passenger. "And you are?"
"I'm Batman," T said.
"Fuck you, I'm fucking Batman, brah. You're Robin."
Moby turned back to Manish.
"He's cool."
Manish grunted disapprovingly.
"If you gentlemen don't mind giving me a ride back to the..."
Moby stomped on the accelerator, kicking up a plume of fine dust that coated Manish head to toe.
"Give you a fucking ride, Pee-wee Herman," T said. "Ain't your fucking chauffeur," Moby said.
A dust cloud trailed the Cadillac as it crossed the complex, although calling it a complex might have been charitable. Moby passed a couple of outbuildings with no clear function, and a garage for box trucks that was in the process of collapsing in on itself. They didn't find Blacktop until they reached a one-time plastics manufacturing plant that was in respectable shape compared to its immediate neighbors. The tiny parking lot hosted one other car, another Caddy, much nicer than Moby's. He got out and did a slow revolution around the car, which, unlike his ride, had made it across the property without picking up a single smudge of dirt.
"See that shit? That's my shit," Moby said. "Getting me one of them."
"Hey, maybe he's going to give it to you. It's your welcome gift. Congratulations on the promotion, motherfucker. Here's your brand new car," T said with a sweeping game show hostess gesture.
They giggled all the way inside. Mr. Hammond stood on the other side of the door, a living roadblock.
"What up, Too Tall?" Moby said.
"Open it up," Hammond said.
With a contemptuous sputter, Moby opened his leather jacket and spun. T did likewise. The grip of a Sig Sauer, its serial number filed away, peeked out from under his belt.
"You know the rules," Hammond said. "Hand it over."
"Man's got a right to protect himself," T protested, "like you ain't packing."
"I'm special."
"Well, whoop-de-fucking-do for you, King Kong. Hey!"
Hammond spun T around and took the pistol. He ejected the magazine, which he pocketed, pulled back the slide to eject the chambered round, and handed the gun back.
"Man's got a right to protect himself," T grumbled. "That's right, he does," Hammond said, stepping aside to let the men pass. "Take off the baseball cap."
"Yeah, whatever," Moby said.
Hammond shadowed them as they crossed the main floor. Whatever function the building had once served, all traces of its former life had been erased. There was no equipment to be seen, no machinery, no vehicles, no crates, no people. Nothing but cinderblock walls and a corrugated steel roof, and a vast concrete plain of a floor. Moby's Nikes, his best pair, had enough padding in the soles to add an inch to his height, yet he could swear his footsteps were echoing. Erkan stood at the far end of the expanse, wandering back and forth in front of a heavy-looking white door set into a cinder-block wall. Brand-new construction, Moby realized as he neared. A heap of tools, a trough for concrete, and leftover materials sat nearby, waiting to be collected.
"Mr. Mantle,"
Erkan said, looking up from the tablet in his hand.
"I asked you to come alone."
"Yeah, you did," Moby said.
"Mm-hmm. And you are?"
Erkan asked T.
"Name's T."
Erkan gestured at the large gold capital T hanging from a thick gold rope around T's neck.
"Is that so you don't forget who you are?"
"You're funny. There's a story behind this," T said, showing off the icon.
"I like stories. Tell me."
"Maybe some other time," Moby said. "What do you want, brah? Got shit to do."
"I imagine. You must be very busy since you took over Bermuda from Juke." "I was surprised and, I'll admit, saddened to hear he was sent to Cedar Junction while I was, indisposed."
"That's what you get for rolling around with a brick of white in your car like a damn fool."
"And you're no fool. Is that what I'm hearing?"
"Straight up."
Erkan nodded.
"Take off your hat, please. I like a sense of professionalism and decorum at my meetings."
Moby touched his middle finger to his custom-made Red Sox cap, a white cap emblazoned with a glittery rhinestone bee, ran it along the edge of the brim, and flicked it at Erkan in mocking salute.
"Mr. Hammond," Erkan said. "You did ask Mr. Mantle to remove his hat."
"Yes, sir,"
Hammond replied.
"Hmm."
Erkan strolled over to the clutter of construction leftovers and searched through a beaten red toolbox. He returned with a staple gun.
"Hold him, please."
Hammond wrapped an arm around Moby's throat. He thrashed and kicked, but Hammond's chokehold was unbreakable. T lunged for the giant, but Erkan stopped the charge cold, looping a punch into T's cheek. The staple gun doubled effectively as a set of brass knuckles.
"That was your one," Erkan said with icy calm. He pointed at T. "Stay there."
and there T stayed, rooted to the spot in mute horror as Erkan pressed the staple gun into Moby's scalp. It snapped a dozen times. With each snap, Moby's screams grew louder. Erkan, the picture of detachment, stepped back and said to T,
"You'll recall I sent a car over to Juke's shop for disposal. An ugly yellow Buick."
T blinked.
"T, I am speaking to you."
Erkan hunkered down, the staple gun dangling from a finger. Beads of red freckled the chromed steel head.
"A yellow Buick. I sent it over Monday for disposal. A contact of mine informed me it was recovered yesterday morning. Does that sound to you like it was properly disposed of?"
"I didn't... That wasn't..." "Aw, shit, man," T whimpered.
"Compose yourself, T," Erkan said. "This is important."
"Moby said to gut the car," T said, an octave higher than normal. "That's all I know, man. He said gut it."
"Does that sound to you like it was properly disposed of?" Erkan pressed.
No, man. Juke would have stripped that motherfucker to the bone, man."
"That's right. He would have. Which is why I used him. He was fast. He was efficient. He was thorough. And he was a professional. Unlike this man," Erkan said, pointing.
Moby's screams had stopped. He was sobbing now. Rivulets of blood rolled down his forehead, mingled with his tears, and washed down his face to soak the sleeve of Hammond's suit jacket.
"I have no use for people who are not professional. Do you understand?"
Yeah.
"I don't know if you do."
Erkan seized T by the collar and hauled him to his feet, then led him over to the white door. T could feel the chill already, through the wall, through his coat. Erkan opened the door. The first wave of air to reach T's nose was moist and cold and flavorless, like the inside of his freezer at home. The second wave had a faintly sour tang to it. It grew stronger as he passed the threshold and entered the room beyond. A meat locker, he thought. It had to be a meat locker. In a sense, it was. A light flickered on. T's stomach held until he gasped and sucked in a lungful of foul air and tasted the rot. Erkan released him, let him purge, then pulled him back up to his knees. He was going to watch. He was going to see what happened to the disloyal, the foolish, the careless. Hammond dragged Moby in by his ankle. His white cap had turned Red Sox red. He reached for T and snagged a handful of his sleeve. T jerked away with a squeal. Moby slid on by, his leather jacket scraping along the concrete.
"Don't you dare close your eyes," Erkan whispered to T. He didn't. He wanted to. He couldn't.
Hammond hoisted Moby to his feet, briefly, and lifted him into the air, and deposited him onto an iron hook dangling from the ceiling, right next to the unrecognizable form of Arnold Park. A thick gout of crimson gushed forth from Moby's mouth. He sucked in a breath, ragged and gurgling, or tried to, and then went limp. Moby Mantle made 5. There were so many more empty hooks available.
"You said there was a story behind your jewelry," Erkan said. "Tell me."
T spit several times, trying to rinse the acid film of bile from the inside of his throat.
"Used to be a, what you call it, a cross with Jesus on it," he said in a hoarse whisper.
"A crucifix?"
"Yeah. Dude shot me once. We's fighting over some bitch. Dude shot at me, bullet hit the cross. Saved my life. Hurt like fuck, but it saved my life."
Erkan bent over to examine the pendant. He could see where the top of the cross had been sheared off, see the faint solder scars where the Lord's hands and feet had once been attached.
You're a very lucky young man, T. Are you also fast?
Erkan asked. T nodded.
Are you efficient?
T nodded.
Are you thorough?
T nodded.
Are you a professional?
T's teeth chattered, but not from the cold.
Yeah. You won't disappoint me like Mr. Mantle did, will you?
No, no, fuck no, hell no.
Prove it.
Anything, man, anything, just don't, please.
The first thing you're going to do is compensate a man I know for the recent theft of his car from the Chandler Hill neighborhood. I looked up the Blue Book value. It's about $3,200. But you can't get anything decent for that money, so you're going to scrape up $5,000. Get the money to me by the end of the week. No excuses.
Yeah, five large, sure.
And then, T, you are going to get your house in order. You tell your people, no more stealing cars in Worcester ever again. Send them to Shrewsbury, Auburn, Paxton, wherever. I don't care, as long as it's anywhere but here in my city. As a former friend of mine recently remarked, you do not shit where you eat. Do you understand?
Yeah.
Erkan waited.
Yes, sir, T said.
If anyone defies you, you give his name to me immediately. Do you understand?
Yes, sir.
And the next time I send a car over and tell you to make it vanish, what are you going to do?
T wiped his nose on the sleeve of his coat.
Strip that motherfucker to the bone.
Erkan's smile was impossibly, inhumanly banal.
I look forward to doing business with you, he said.
The problem with being a businessman, completely legitimate or otherwise, is that it is not a physical activity. The ratio of time spent in a chair to time spent moving favors inertia. For a while, Erkan turned a blind eye to his increasing girth, brushing it off as inconsequential, even when he had to twice in one summer buy whole new wardrobes that didn't constrict his midsection. Isabel finally dumped a bucket of ice-cold reality over his head when she refused to let him be on top anymore, because, quote, "You're crushing me." A line like that cannot be delivered gently, no matter how hard one tries, and no matter how much love is behind it. The idea of going to a gym, of pacing on a treadmill on a slow journey to nowhere, or hefting barbells surrounded by grunting apes high on their own testosterone, left him cold. He tried a personal trainer who came to his office 3 times a week, but found the routine monotonous. It was, surprisingly, the unassuming little Mr. Manish who suggested taking up a martial art. He himself attended twice-weekly classes in a watered-down version of that nasty Israeli form, Krav Maga, because he needed something more engaging than a gym workout to shed what he called executive privilege-induced pudge. The self-defense aspect of his chosen workout regimen was a happy bonus. After experimenting with a few styles, Erkan found a calling in kendo and dove in headfirst. His first teacher, Hachiru Himura, a 7-dan master with a soft voice and a heavy hand, honored Erkan's request to be pushed and driven and challenged. He honored that request with great enthusiasm. All that protective gear couldn't prevent Erkan from returning home with an assortment of bruises every night. Bruises and a proud grin. Today was that first day all over again. Erkan's current instructor, Nicholas, who'd achieved 6th Dan and once had the honor of sparring against 8th Dan master Shozo Kato, served up a harsh reminder of how much work lay ahead, before he was back in peak form. He insisted Nicholas pull no punches, and the cocky bastard obliged. For a solid hour, Erkan endured the unrelenting crack, crack, crack of Nicholas's shinai as it worked him over, head, body, and limbs, delivering 10 blows for every one received. Erkan returned home battered and bruised and grinning. He took a shower and then took Isabel to bed and fucked her with animal abandon, pulling her hair and biting her and delighting in her screams. Once he'd recovered, Isabel returned the favor. Agony and ecstasy intertwined, indistinguishable. The lines Erkan had blurred, Isabel erased. Spent, they skipped dinner to remain in bed, wrapped around one another, their flesh throbbing and burning. Isabel purred her contentment and pressed against her husband, and rejected his apology for hurting her. He could never hurt her, she said. Not in any way that mattered. He apologized again anyway. He had hurt her badly, just the once, by nearly dying on her. Not his fault, but he owned the guilt regardless, and vowed it would never happen again. He lowered his head to a scratch on Isabel's skin, mirroring the line of her collarbone, and ran his tongue along it, tasting the salt and the copper, and he promised himself he'd never let anyone hurt her ever again. He swore this on her blood. 13. Times like this reminded Rose why she turned down a chance to make detective. It wasn't the fact that detective was barely a promotion, though that played into it. Detective Sergeant was basically a sergeant with a little more pay and a lot more responsibility. So much so that the detective's workloads often spilled over onto the patrol officers. They were the ones sent out to canvas whenever the detectives themselves couldn't, and that work was tedious. Street work could get monotonous and repetitive, but detective work was tedious. 90% of the job was asking the same questions over and over to people who didn't know a thing, or claimed not to, in the hope that someone, anyone, might say something worth a damn. Even when someone did have information, half the time that information turned out to be worthless, and the only way to determine that was to ask the same questions over and over to people who didn't know a thing or claimed not to, in the hope someone, anyone, might say something worth a damn. Today was a tedious day for detectives by proxy, Rose and Aldwin. The first three alleged chop shops were apparent dead ends that yielded no useful info as to the current whereabouts of one Arnold Park of Shrewsbury, presumably missing for just over 48 hours. None of the men in the so-called garages claimed they saw a mustard-yellow Buick pass through within the past 3 days, or ever. Rose expected nothing different from number four. The people who worked in such places, they never knew a thing, even when they did. This place reeked of a dead end. Despite what the old faded wooden sign above the main garage bay door claimed, Bermuda Auto and Body Repair, established 1965, hadn't been a proper auto and body repair shop in years. It might have all the licenses and permits it needed to operate as such, and there might be cars inside and people working on them, but this wasn't the kind of place you'd send a friend to get his engine tuned up or have a ding in the quarter panel removed. "This is why I got into police work," Aldwin said, smirking. "The excitement." "Excitement's overrated," Rose said distantly. "What do we have on this place?" Aldwin consulted a small notepad. "Ford said a guy who went by the name Juke ran it until a few months ago, when he got sent to Cedar Junction for trafficking. Now it's some guy named Moby, who Ford describes as, quote, a bit of a retard. His words, not mine." They got out of the cruiser. Rose looked around. Go one direction and they'd hit a cluster of smaller mills, all of which were clean and well-kept and filled with businesses. Go the other and they'd hit a main drag that boasted two diners and four small used car lots within easy walking distance of one another. This back street? It was a no-man's land, an anti-oasis. But once upon a time, it had been a thriving little area. The former brick mill that housed Bermuda was also a home to a tattoo parlor, which had recently relocated according to a handwritten sign in the window, a lighting appliance outlet, which had not so recently gone out of business according to a store-bought sign on its front door, and a dance studio, which had no informative signs, but did have a sheet of plywood over its glass front door. A small building across the street once served the neighborhood as a convenience store. Rose imagined the clerks would have known every customer by name, their buying habits, which sections of the newspaper they'd read, and which they'd toss straight into the trash.
"This area cannot be gentrified fast enough," Aldwyn said.
The two rust-caked bay doors were down, but they did nothing to buffer the sounds of industry within, of hydraulic tools blurting and bursting, of socket wrenches clicking and ticking, of men shouting boisterously and hurling insults at each other with good humor. They went in through a side door. For reasons Rose was never able to figure out, budget cars like Hondas and Toyotas and Hyundais were commonplace in these little outlaw garages. Their owners liked to trick them out with comically huge spoilers and mufflers that amplified rather than muffled, and repaint them in atomic hues, transforming them into cartoonish parodies of proper sports cars. She counted two Civics, one Accord, and a retina-burning lime-green Sentra. Each had its own personal mechanic. An African-American man laboring on the radioactive Sentra rose up to his full height. Rose wondered how he managed to fold his NBA frame into his car. He regarded the officers coolly.
"What up?" he said.
He wiped a hand on his tank top, adding a fresh, greasy handprint to the collection. "Afternoon. I'm Sergeant Booker. This is Officer Aldwyn," Rose said. "Are you the manager of this garage by any chance?"
"No managers here, Sergeant. This here is what you might call a co-op."
He gestured with the socket wrench in his hand, which he then put down on the vinyl apron cloaked over the front of the engine compartment. He spoke and moved like someone who'd dealt with police before, many times. Slowly, carefully, non-threateningly.
"We rent space so we can work on our vehicles in private."
"And who do you pay rent to?"
"Bermuda Auto and Body Repair. We put our money in the box every month."
He pointed out a birdhouse-like box mounted near the door.
"And someone collects it."
"Mind if I talk to you, then?"
The man folded his hands at his waist and shrugged.
"A 2015 Buick Regal was found recently under the overpass near Holy Cross," Rose said. "It had been professionally stripped to the frame. We're checking in with local garages to see if anyone might know anything about that."
"Can't say I do, Sergeant."
"So you haven't seen a car matching that description come through here any time recently?"
"Can't say I have, Sergeant."
She had a few more questions lined up, variations of the theme designed to trip up suspects, get them to contradict themselves. But Rose's attention left the tall man and went right to the young African-American man skittering across the bay floor. He froze upon spotting the unexpected visitors, a deer in the headlights. "Thank you," Rose said to the person no longer of interest, and she walked up to the man with the big gold T hanging around his neck. "Good afternoon."
"Yeah, hi," T said.
Rose introduced herself. T introduced himself. "T," Rose said pleasantly, "do you have time to answer a few questions?" T looked her up and down, his face tight.
"Yeah, whatever."
"Can we go someplace private?"
"We can talk right here,"
T said, his bravado escalating a notch.
"I ain't got nothing to hide."
Rose locked her smile down. No one announces he has nothing to hide for no reason. Aldwyn settled back to enjoy the show. Rose opened with her standard question about the discovery of Park's car. T said he knew nothing about it. She rephrased the inquiry a few different times to make it sound like a completely different question. T remained consistent in his replies, but his demeanor jumped, pinging between restrained arrogance and affected indifference to thinly feigned innocent ignorance. "Thank you, T. You've been very helpful," Rose said with a straight face. "Is Moby here? We'd like to speak with him." Microtells. That's what one of her academy instructors called the minute twitches that sneak across a suspect's face when he's lying or withholding. It wasn't an exact science, he'd said. And anyone who claims any given quirk has an exact and universal meaning is full of shit. But the only people who don't have microtells are the innocent and sociopaths. T's face was telling quite a story.
"Ain't seen him in a while," T said after a too long pause.
"Define a while," Rose said.
"I don't know."
"I see. If I were to ask everyone else in this garage when they saw Moby last, they'd say..."
"Wednesday."
"About when?"
"I don't know. Ain't his mother."
"I understand he took over after Juke went away."
"I guess."
"But he hasn't been in since Wednesday."
"I ain't seen him."
"You sure about that?" Rose won the staring contest.
"All right, look, I gave the dude a lift Wednesday morning. Dropped him off. Haven't seen him since."
"A lift where?"
"Donkeys."
"Which one?"
"Fuck if I know. There's a million of the fucking things."
"Did he say why he needed a ride?"
"He wanted coffee."
"He couldn't drive himself?" T gave a sharp, stiff shrug.
"Dude asked me for a ride. I gave him a ride. Didn't want his life story."
"So you weren't friends?"
"I knew the guy. Know all these guys."
"Do you hang out with any of them?"
"Sometimes, maybe."
"Okay, so you gave Moby a ride to Dunkin' Donuts, but not a lift back. Is that right?"
"Dude said he's meeting someone. Assumed he'd get a ride back with him."
"Who?"
"I don't know," T said, agitated. "Told you, he didn't say and I didn't ask. His business, man."
"And you've had no contact with him since?"
"Nah."
"And you're not worried that he hasn't been in since then?"
"He's a big boy."
T shrugged again.
"Dude's got like 6 baby mamas. All I know, he skipped out because one of them's on his ass about child support or whatever. Done it before."
"I see." Rose locked eyes with T. "Is there anything else you'd like to tell me, sir?" T's features fell quiet, eerily so. And he said, in a monotone,
"I gave the man a ride for coffee, dropped him off, and I haven't seen him since. That's all I know."
As a matter of routine, Rose and Aldwyn questioned the other men, and they all told the same story. Moby came in Wednesday, left with T for reasons unknown. T came back alone, and Moby fell off the radar.
"That was quite the climb up bullshit mountain," Aldwyn said upon returning to the cruiser.
"That it was," Rose said.
"Think Moby ran?"
"Don't know. That guy T was definitely covering for him."
"Maybe, but you know what? Not our problem anymore. We did our job, so now we bump it up the ladder and let the detectives do with it what they will."
"Yeah." Aldwyn pulled away from the curb. Rose, driven by a nagging itch at the back of her brain, fired up the onboard laptop. She got a hit immediately. Richard Mantle, one known alias, Moby, age 27, 6'2", 181 pounds, black hair, brown eyes. Distinguishing marks included a scar from a gunshot wound on his left shoulder blade, the letters Thug on the fingers of his right hand, and Life on the left, a bad portrait of Tupac on his left bicep, and the words Only God Can Judge Me arching over his navel. His extensive criminal record included multiple counts of disorderly conduct and disturbing the peace, 2 counts of A and B, and 1 count of possession of stolen property, to wit, a motor vehicle. There was a recent notation, 2 days old. Shanti Ames reported her boyfriend, Richard Moby Mantle, missing Thursday morning after he failed to return home from work the previous night.
"Excuse me, miss. Is this seat taken?" Julie said.
"It is now," Rose said. Julie slid onto the neighboring bar stool.
"Your home life must truly be in shambles if you have chosen to go day drinking with me after work rather than go home to your man."
Rose made a sour face.
Was I a little too on the nose?
A lot too. Julie's shrug was as much of an apology as Rose sensed she was going to get. Her beer ordered, delivered, and half consumed, Julie said,